Welcome to Closing the Gap, an educational podcast on gender bias in medicine. I'm Amber Sobrario, founder of this podcast, an emergency medicine physician at the San Antonio Military Medical Center.
And I'm Laura Smiley, an emergency physician at Detroit Receiving Hospital. This podcast series is brought to you by our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a not-for-profit democratic emergency medicine group in Detroit, and Feminem.
The views expressed are those of the author and do not reflect the official views or policy of the Department of Defense or its components. In our first episode, we wanted to answer some of the basic questions for our listeners. What is gender equity? Why is it an issue in medicine? And why should you care? Gender equity isn't just treating everyone the same. It's giving individuals what they need to be successful while leveling the playing field.
So why are we even talking about this? It's not the 1950s, it's 2019. But when you look around at the news, at social media, and when you dive into the research on this topic, you find the results to be not as progressive as you would expect. Look at your own group. Are women equally represented? Are there as many women leaders as male leaders? And when you start to notice these things, you see inequity everywhere.
Don't just take our word for it. Listen to real accounts of women physicians across the U.S. who experience inequity and gender bias in medicine every day. The identities of the persons sharing their stories, along with the identities of any persons or institutions for which they are about, have been kept anonymous.
So almost a year ago, I came to my institution as a woman in leadership, and I'm still currently the only woman in leadership in my department, in either departmental leadership or residency leadership. And shortly after I got there, I started to see, and a lot of the female residents started to come up to me to talk about their experience in the residency and talk to me about how they felt like they were treated. And I was amazed and a little baffled. A lot of the female residents told me that they felt like they had been put into the Medical Knowledge Improvement Plan as interns even before they had taken their in-service, and this wasn't really based on any objective data, and they felt like they were being targeted just because they were perceived as weaker residents early on and because they were women. They definitely perceive a change in our department of how they are treated versus the male residents. When they're trying to run a resuscitation, a lot of the nurses will call a male resident to come into the room to help out. They're not listened to. They're like, it's very palpable, like how different we're treated in the department compared to our male colleagues.
I am fellowship trained in critical care medicine. I work in both the medical ICU and the emergency department at my institution. When I first got hired, I noticed that our ED did not document critical care time on patients who were clearly critical. It seemed to be a problem among all the staff rather than just a rare few. I brought this to the attention of our departmental leadership. I mentioned it at staff meetings, I brought it up during shifts, I even talked to our billers about it individually, who agreed that our staff was underbilling. I mentioned it again at a staff meeting and informed our administrators that we, as a department, were losing significant amounts of money from our underbilling and that this was something that I could help fix. I never heard anything about it. Then one staff meeting about 6 months later, one of our male attendings, with no specific knowledge by his own admission of critical care documentation or billing, starts presenting a PowerPoint presentation on critical care billing. Very clearly, it was a superficial talk on ACEP's definition of critical care, things he had copied and pasted from their website. He ended the talk with stating that we are underbilling as a department and we should explore steps to improve this, although presented no plan on how to do this. Multiple staff members came up to me asking why he was presenting this topic and not me. I had no idea why. I was never told he was doing this, and he certainly never thought to ask me my opinion on it. I did confront him on this, and he simply said, "I was asked by our medical director to look into this. I don't know why I didn't think to ask you about it." I ultimately went to our chair and division administrator and told them how absurd it was that I was excluded from a problem that I brought to everyone's attention and that I actually have additional training in. I then informed them that I was going to be conducting my own study, I would teach half of our faculty how to document critical care time using a case-based approach, and then compare my intervention group to the rest of the department to see who billed better. After 3 months, the intervention group had a 206% increase compared to the control group in critical care charges. The intervention extrapolated over 12 months is estimated to increase departmental charges by $3 million. During this time, we had a new chair start in our department who was very interested in my leading this initiative, but I never got an answer as to why I was ever excluded from something I actually know a lot about. It appears that a man who knows less is still preferred over a woman who knows more, regardless of the topic.
I was working a couple of weeks ago with a nurse who kept calling me doctor. I finally said to the nurse, you know my name, why do you keep calling me doctor? We laughed about it and he followed me back to the charting area. He said, I call everyone with an MD or PhD doctor. If you put that amount of work in, you deserve to be called doctor. I felt empowered, respected, and energized. 4 days earlier, I had a completely different experience with a male attending. I wasn't paired to work with his attending, but he was hanging out in our charting area. I had just seen two patients, was half thinking about my orders and half answering the med student's question. As soon as I entered the room, he barked at me. Yo, you're not offended when someone calls you a nurse, right? I said, well, no. And he said, good, good, good. I don't know why you guys get offended. I mean, this other attending has been called a nurse and she's been here for 30 years. It's a compliment. If someone calls you a nurse, it's a compliment. And then he abruptly left the room. My reaction was confusion, as there was really no context for this rant. My interpretation of the interaction was that he was trying to shut me up. He asked me a leading question when I wasn't able to give my full attention, and then he told me how I should react to a situation that he's frankly never experienced, in essence, so he doesn't have to deal with it. People call me a nurse because I'm a woman. It's an assumption from people who don't see female physicians. I understand this. It's okay. I'm not offended when people refer to me as a nurse. It's not an insult, but it's not a compliment. I do find it annoying because people tend to ask me for phones and blankets and bedpans and water every time I walk into a module. So I'm in the situation where I can point to our understaffed nursing crew and say, ask them, or stop my thought process and help with a task. I probably do about 8 to 10 nursing tasks a shift. That's 3 to 5 minutes per task to find stuff for people and at least 8 to 10 minutes for bedpan stuff. That's almost 75 minutes of stuff patients ask of me of a shift because I look like a nurse. And that's okay. We work in an underserved department and we're part of a team, and that's okay. There are times when it's aggravating, and that's still okay. But what is frustrating is to tell me to not have a reaction because you've deemed it a compliment.
I had an instance early in my career when I was moonlighting. Again, the first woman to moonlight in this particular place. And in the middle of the night, I had a patient with a rupturing abdominal aortic aneurysm. And I called the surgeon on call. This is in a community hospital. And I said, I need you to come in. I have a guy who's rupturing. No, I don't have a confirmed diagnosis yet, except that there's nothing else this could be. I feel it. And he stopped me in the middle of the conversation. It's 2 a.m. He stopped me in the middle of the conversation and said, what are your qualifications? And I had this moment of,
oh my God.
Yeah, I did it. And I'm so glad I didn't do something stupid. I took a breath, did that step back thing you're supposed to do. And I didn't even know I was doing it at the time, but I did. And I thought, okay, in my brain, I think I need this patient taken care of. And this person's going to give me a hassle. And I finally took a breath and I said, would you have asked me that if I were a man? And to his credit, he took a long breath and said, no, I'll be right in.
I understand if the attendings don't want to talk with me during shift. Maybe it's because we have nothing in common. I try to make it happen, but the response is that they're not interested in talking to me. But I just feel like I'm falling behind my male co-residents because I lack that buddy-buddy relationship. I feel like they're moving forward faster than me because the attendings are investing more in them. I try to run a code, and most of the time I can't even get 2 words out before the majority of the male attendings just take over. I thought maybe it was because I'm just a second-year resident, but then I saw my multiple male co-residents of the same PGY level run codes with the same attendings, and they were allowed to run everything and do everything. I really feel like I'm falling behind my male colleagues when it comes to learning. I don't know what else to do.
When I was a fellow, I was seeing a critical care consult in the ED when one of the attendings told me he was having a hard time explaining to the son of a patient how sick his father actually was. I said I would try to reiterate the same. He then said, well, you're a woman. Maybe he'll listen to you better. You have more assets than I do.
I had to work with a male attending on a different service for a whole month. He had a long reputation for discriminatory, unprofessional, inappropriate behavior, particularly with minorities and women. I had at the time assumed that at least some of it was an exaggeration until I experienced working with him. It actually seemed like being one of those required, this is what you shouldn't do, HR videos that you have to watch when starting a job. And I have plenty of stories just from this guy. Once he told my male resident in front of me and about me that she needs to shut up and raise her hand if she wants to talk. And then another time he barked, do you need elocution lessons, at my female senior of Korean descent. And once, despite the fact that he was not, in fact, an emergency medicine doctor, said to me that in his opinion, ER has a lot of action, and so it's more of a man's job, and that's why there are more men than women in EM. During that same conversation, he began to passionately discuss how men cannot express opinions anymore. He delved into the then recent news of Google firing a male employee for saying that in technology, women are not as intelligent as men. He proceeded to agree with that employee, saying that in jobs such as engineering and many types of medicine, there are more men than women because, in his opinion, women weren't good at systems-based jobs or engineering. And when I responded by saying that we have more women than men in my residency class and that my sister is a successful engineer at Google, he talked over me loudly and discounted everything that I had said with a wave of his hand. And then we were recounting this to the chief of that particular service, who happens to be another Caucasian male. The meeting was held in a small conference room. The moment myself and my female senior sat down, he said, girls, first things first, let's stick to the facts and not get emotional about anything. I mean, thanks for the tip, man. Maybe you should have told your employee that before he started yelling at his residents to shut up or if they need to be taught English.
Despite the progress women have made over time, we're still not sitting at the table as often as men. And when we are at the table, it doesn't seem to translate to having an equal voice or staying at the table. So we brought in two experts. One, to summarize the deficits. Two, to debunk the myths about why there is a gender gap. And three, explain why you should care as an individual and an institution. So I want to welcome our first guest, Dr. Esther Chu, a physician who graduated from Yale School of Medicine, completed her residency in emergency medicine at Boston Medical Center, and earned a health service research fellowship at Oregon Health and Science University. She's an associate professor in the Center for Policy and Research in the Department of Emergency Medicine at OHSU. Dr. Chu's research focuses on women's health, intimate partner violence, substance misuse, and tech-based interventions. She has won multiple awards for her research. She is founder of the Equity Quotient, a company that measures detailed equity metrics in the healthcare workplace. She's a great champion, mentor, and advocate for achieving racial and gender equality in medicine. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here.
We also have with us today Dr. Dara Kass, a physician who earned her MD at SUNY Downstate Medical School, completed her residency in emergency medicine at Kings County Hospital, and currently is an assistant professor at Columbia University in New York City. Prior to that, she was director of undergraduate medical education at NYU and an assistant program director at Staten Island University Hospital. She's the founder of FeminM, an open access resource that explores and addresses the gender disparities in medicine. She is a champion for advancing women in medicine. She's invited regularly to speak on topics such as professional development of women, unconscious bias, and achieving gender equity in emergency medicine. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This episode, our first episode, is on framing the problem. And the first step is acknowledging that there is a problem. There's several theories circulating about why there is a gender gap. We'd like to play a little game of Mythbusters to address this. So first off, is there a gender gap because there are not enough women in medicine?
Dr. Chu, what do you think?
Classic assumption. I vote false.
I vote false as well. Well, let's look at the data, right? There are 50% of the incoming medical students are female, correct?
Just past 50%. So we just surpassed it for the first time in 2017. But of course, to be fair, we've been really close to 50% for more than 25 years now. And so you would think that some of that just about equity in numbers would have filtered up and solved all our problems.
Like at the pipeline, right, Esther? Isn't that a thing that they talk about? Okay, so let's see. So myth number one is the gender gap has nothing to do with the fact that there are not enough women entering medical school classes. Let's kind of leave that myth there. Okay, what's the next one, guys?
So more specifically, maybe there aren't enough women in our specialty of emergency medicine, and that's why we haven't achieved equality.
Ooh, that's a harder one. So, Chu, do you want to try that one first?
I think I would apply the same concepts from the bigger question that we know there's a wage gap in emergency medicine that is not explained. Is it simply that there's not enough women in the room? I would also say false. I think there's a couple problems there. One is that assuming that all we need for parity is just getting enough women to make sure that people behave fairly. And I think that's assuming that men impose bias on women when in fact it's actually men and women who are biased against women in the workplace. So it's not a simple headcount that perpetuates this problem. Right. What do you think?
And just to be clear, right, 38% of emergency medicine residents are female. We know that. So we're not going to say, okay, when we get to 50, the problem's going away, right? And you look at that simply and you say, we know that it's not half. So whether it is half going into medical school and emergency medicine is not a 50-50 specialty, but we also know that specialties that have 60% female residents also have gender gaps for salary and promotion. So clearly, just getting to a 50-50 split in any specialty in the House of Medicine is not what is related to the gender gap.
It's kind of a sad commentary, too. It's like, we can't be fair unless there's enough women to come here and make sure and be what, the police of equity? You know what I mean? It's like, is fairness not possible if there's only 10% women? Like, what is the threshold so that everybody behaves themselves, you know?
we're not supposed to be surly until the end of the podcast, Esther. Okay, so we're supposed to be optimistic.
All right, next one.
Maybe women aren't interested in promotion because they have other priorities like families.
Oh, I want to do this one. That's so false. And that it makes me anxious and angry at the same time, right? So that is actually a whole field of medicine and social science called benevolent sexism, right? And we know that presuming what somebody else's priorities are based on their gender, even if you think you're doing good by them, you're not. So I'm not even going to have a conversation about one. I'm going to kill this myth right now and say that is not true. Women are not interested in promotion because they have a family.
No, I was going to say it's not empirically backed up either. There's all these surveys out there that are like, are you interested in promotion? And the numbers of women interested in advancing their careers is pretty equal or sometimes exceeds the number of men who are interested in promoting their careers. And yes, and it's also so critical of men, like they're not interested and they don't prioritize their families. So it's kind of insulting all around.
Overall, total BS.
Total BS.
Benevolent sexism. We're not swearing on this podcast yet.
Right. It's just total benevolent sexism. Go ahead.
Okay. Last one. Maybe women aren't as talented in the field of medicine as men are.
I mean, that one is really hard to disprove. Dr. Chu, is there any data that says that women are equally as talented as men in medicine?
This is my favorite area of emerging science. I actually am amazed I haven't done one of these studies yet. It is my aspiration in life, but there's been a number of wonderful studies that look at patient outcomes, like hard patient outcomes like survival, depending on whether you are quasi-randomized to women versus male physicians. And it looks like outcomes are overall pretty similar. If anything, in some circumstances, having a woman physician in the room appears to improve outcomes. And I think it's pretty clear that a diversity in the team improves outcomes.
See, that's the point. That's of this whole myth idea, is that each of these things, it's not the pipeline, right? It's the process. So we know that we have enough women going in. We know that even if we had a critical mass of women in emergency medicine, we would still not do anything for the gender gap, because in specialties that have more than half women, they have the same gaps we do. We know that you cannot presume, and it's been disproven, whether or not somebody wants to be promoted based upon their gender. And we know for damn certain that women are not inferior doctors.
We sure do.
So with that, doctors, I would love to know about the next section because I think we've debunked all of your myths.
So let's move on to the next section. So the main point is that we have the numbers, we have the talent, and we want the position, but we're not getting an equal shot at the game. So if it's not any of those things, what is it?
So I think that to say it's one thing is to oversimplify the issue. But I think there's one thing that's kind of common to all of the other things that we're going to find, especially as this topic is discussed over time. So we know that implicit and explicit bias, but gender-based biases affect almost every aspect of a physician's career as they play into the gender gap. Implicit bias and gender-based bias is like the fertile soil by which each of these inequities grow. But a lot of times when you look at the inequities head-to-head, they'll look like they're for an objective reason.
No, I totally agree. And that's why these studies are so hard. And I think when there are, I mean, the way that that Bapujina, who's one of these Harvard researchers, frames it is, he said, we take all these measurable things to try to explain why there is a salary gap or why there's a promotions gap. And when you subtract out all the potential confounders, what's left is likely to be related to bias. But the problem with those studies is that everything you put in that's a potential confounder has a piece of bias in it. For example, when we look at the salary gap, we will take into account leadership positions because leadership positions come with a higher salary. So we'll say, well, maybe men just get paid more because they have all the leadership positions. And so let's subtract that out. And then you're like, wait a second, why do men have all the leadership positions that are higher paid? I mean, there's a piece of bias in that whole process of coming up as a leader in medicine, your mentorship and your sponsorship and how you're seen and what's considered to be your leadership potential. So it's just so funny that we subtract out these chunks of data that themselves are biased because they represent opportunity. So all that is just to say that when we try to measure the effect of bias, it is probably an underestimate of the true influence of bias because bias is so woven into everything that we consider, including these so-called objective measures of productivity. So yeah, I'm just backing up what Dr. Cass said.
I like that.
The other thing is that it's not just subtraction, right? Some of these things are synergistic. And so we totally underestimate the effect of this gender bias when it is interwoven, like you said.
So to build off of that, let's dive into some of the deficits and we'll start with the most obvious. Dr. Chu, can you walk us through some of the data for those of us out there who don't know or refuse to believe that there is a pay gap in medicine?
Yeah, there have been numerous studies now, all done at different times and different ways using different types of data, looking at different subsections of population. And I will just say, when you see data that's that consistent over time, even when done with different methods, with a fairly similar estimate of effect, you start to really believe it. And so a couple of the notable and really high visibility studies I'll talk through. One was a big study of gender differences in physician salary across U.S. public medical schools. This study was published in JAMA Internal Medicine, and it took advantage of the fact that at public medical schools, they're required to be very open about the salaries that are given. And so they're just, you know, they're very visible to the public, and they're able to take that information and then merge it with data about physician clinical and academic productivity. And so all in all, they looked at over 10,000 academic physicians at 24 public medical schools, and they controlled for all the things that you were supposed to control for, things like age and years since residency. There was a proxy for clinical productivity. There was adjustment for publications and NIH funding and participation in clinical trials and the specialty that you practiced and your faculty rank, since that's linked to compensation. And when they put all of that in, they found that there was still an unexplained almost $20,000 difference in salary. So that was one of the larger and more compelling pieces of data.
Okay, but what about those people in the community? Do you see similar results that you do in academia?
Of course, people always say, well, that's academia. Isn't it better in the community because there's more objective measures like, I don't know, like Press Ganey or RVUs and things like that? Of course, there are a million ways that inequity can still creep in no matter what metrics you use. to gauge that. And so there's been a salary survey, a compensation report put out by Doximity for 2 years running. And both of those studies show that there was a gap of, I think most recently in 2017, there was a gap of $100,000 across male and female physicians. That Doximity study took only people who worked 40 hours or more a week. So they selected out the people who were full-time so that you could sort of dispense with this notion that it had to do with part-time work that women may choose more often. And then on top of that, they controlled for hours worked and for specialty and for geographic location and for years in practice. So a lot of important potential confounders were included in the analysis, and they still found that there was this big physician gender gap and with female doctors earning about $100,000 less than their male counterparts. And they actually found that in more than half of about 50 metro areas, there was an increase in the physician wage gap, the physician gender wage gap compared to the year before. And the walk away from that study was that there's not a single specialty in which women earn more than men. You know, so people will say things like, well, I mean, this whole notion of get enough women in and these disparities will level out. But it didn't matter if you looked at OB-GYN, family medicine, pediatrics, all these specialties that are women friendly, where they have half or more of their physicians are women, it has not closed. So it was another, that study had embedded within it a little myth buster about what the presence, the mere headcount presence of women does.
Whoa. So you're telling me specialties that are dominated by women, I'm talking 80% women, like OBGYN, women still earn less than men. Well, then what about our specialty of emergency medicine? Is there a pay gap there?
So, and I will say there was a study in academic emergency medicine that also looked at salaries across a bunch of emergency medicine academic departments. That data was directly from administrators, so it was not self-reported, so it took out the reporting bias. That showed very similar results to the JAMA Internal Medicine paper. We are a mid-earning specialty, and our salary gap was also in the 19,000s, almost 20,000, so entirely consistent with the JAMA Internal Medicine paper after doing some really smart sub-analyses and ways of stratifying the data to make sure we're comparing apples to apples.
All right. Finally, what about the physicians that are graduating from residency? Should they be concerned about a wage gap?
There have been studies on the salary gap among new residency grads. So before you've really had a chance to distinguish yourself by any, you know, real accomplishments, no offense to residents out there. It seems like starting out at the gate, right after residency graduation, your very first job in New York State, they found that there was a almost $17,000 salary gap, and that gap seemed to be actually growing over time rather than getting better, even though we are increasing the proportion of women in medical school. So all in all, the salary data is very compelling, and it's very consistent that women are still behind for unexplained reasons that are likely to be due to bias.
Yeah, I completely agree. The data is so compelling that we're going to dedicate an entire episode to just the gender pay gap in medicine. But we are going to move on, and we're going to start talking about promotion and how gender bias affects that. As we see women climb the ladder in academia, there's fewer and fewer women in higher leadership positions. Dr. Cass, what do you think the problem is with promotion for women in academics?
So I think that it's actually, this is like a really kind of complicated, multifaceted issue. That's kind of what I was talking about like the like fertile soil in the beginning and the other contributing factors. So if you look at like high level jobs, so like CEOs, chairs, board of directors, right? You'll look around the landscape of the people that are already at the level right below and say, who's qualified? And if you don't get enough people to that level of qualification right below the highest level, then you don't have the talent pool to objectively pull the people in the highest leadership position. So a lot of times we look at the pipeline and say, where are the greatest drop-offs, right? And we know that in academic medicine, the greatest drop-off is between assistant professor and associate professor. As it gets to the place by which, where do you look for your vice chairs of education or your vice chair of research? It's amongst your associate professor pool. And the drop-off in academic medicine goes from like the 30s to the 20s from assistant to associate. And so we look at why does that happen? Is it because women don't want to be promoted? We already talked about the idea that that is benevolent sexism and it's actually functionally not true. Is it the process of promotion is so biased in some institutions that it's nearly impossible for a lot of women to get promoted? Yes, it's true. Okay. So one of the biggest contributing factors to the idea that we don't have enough women at high levels of leadership is that the process to get there is laden with a lot of issues that were created for a workforce that is not inclusive. So you think about in order to get promoted at traditional academic centers in the highest levels, you have to have a certain number of papers, you have to have given certain grand rounds, you have had to done things in a very specific way. And we know that there is gender bias in every contributing factor that gives to your promotion. So there is gender bias in resident and student evaluations of faculty. There is bias in faculty evaluations of residents. We know there's actually bias in publication, in first authorship, in commentaries and invited articles, in editorial positions. So I think that all of those factors, and when you're in my position and you look critically at why, you start to see all these places, these kind of microaggressions that are happening to women in medicine, but that are happening across the board. And remember that all of these factors are confounded if you're in a double minority. So if you're a female physician of color, or if you're a member of the LGBT community, and we know that that's why as you look to higher and higher levels of leadership anywhere, you just don't see the diversity we see at the front level.
Amen.
Really well put. So we are going to move on to our final topic. And we're going to discuss sexual harassment in medicine. And it is a very disturbing topic and a very nauseating topic, especially since there was a recent consensus report on sexual harassment of women in science, engineering, and medicine. And it showed very unexpected results that are very depressing. Dr. Chu, I know you've looked into this research before. Would you care to elaborate on these findings?
Yeah, I appreciate this topic in this podcast because I really think that if we're going to talk about inequity, we have to talk about harassment. And if we're going to talk about harassment, we have to talk about inequity. I mean, these issues are inextricably linked. And I really feel that part of our lack of success in either realm is that we have pretended that they are separate. And actually, they're very hard to address if we try to address them in isolation.
Well, so Dr. Chu, do you have an analogy?
Darren knows my favorite analogy. And so for me, it's like trying to correct hypokalemia without addressing the MAG, you know, which is also my favorite clinical teaching point. If any of my residents want to listen to this and impress me, but you know, we will pound these patients with potassium and then we'll can't figure out why they have rebound hypokalemia. And it's because we haven't repleted their MAG. You know, those problems go together and are very hard to address. And so, and I think that's a lot about what has happened. I mean, we keep on trying to fix harassment in the context of an environment where there's steep hierarchy, where there's a male dominant environment, where there's almost purely male leadership. And we know that that is kind of the petri dish for harassment to occur. And so as long as women are not moving up, they're not being promoted, they're not being supported, they're not receiving equitable salaries, then how do we fix a harassment problem? Because there's a fundamental power dynamic that does not allow these problems to stop. And so, I mean, that is what the report, the National Academy's report was really about. It wasn't just about the super high rates of harassment, which is true. There are very high rates. And much like these other problems, surprisingly, they are not getting better over time. The other highlights of the report that I think are important for people to know is that we aim really low when it comes to fixing these problems. So in academia and in medicine in general, we tend to aim to avoid litigation, which is really an organization-focused goal, right? We don't try to do surveillance. We don't try to prevent harassment from happening in the first place. We're very reactive. We basically wait for formal complaints or for lawsuits before we respond. And so all we do at best is really secondary prevention. We don't do things to try to build a culture where harassment can't happen in the first place. And I think
it's the lowest possible bar, right? The lowest possible bar.
It is the lowest hanging fruit. It's a goal that is miserably low. And we can do so much better. And I think what this report laid out very well is that harassment has very clear mental and physical effects on the targets of harassment. And for us in healthcare, that hits particularly hard. I mean, we are about improving mental and physical health, and yet we were the worst. So among science, engineering, and medical fields, we were the worst in allowing harassment to occur at a very high rate. So in this report, they commented on studies where female medical students have reported by the time they graduate, about 50% of them have been exposed to harassment in their training environment. And I mean, that's before they even started their careers, you know, so just imagine then they go out into the workforce where they, you know, they don't even have people who are responsible for them, like, you know, like Title IX offices or school ombudsmen. And so, you know, it's that made me feel really sick. I joined you in feeling nauseous over it because of anybody who should be protecting their people, their employees and their trainees from something that causes clear mental and physical sequelae and is really destructive on their working experience, you would think that we would be the best. And instead, we were the worst.
So that is so unacceptable, and it's so disturbing. And it makes me wonder, does sexual harassment in the workplace only affect the victim?
The negative effects aren't just on the target. So it affects the people who witness the harassment. It affects the entire working group. It actually bleeds out to entire organizations. So when you allow harassment, it's not just like, oh, I feel so bad for the people who are harassed. We should. We definitely should. And we need to do so much more in terms of support for people who have experienced harassment, responding rapidly to their complaints, making sure that there is correction and restitution. But we should feel bad for our entire organizations, that we allow that and that toxin spreads and actually makes it a terrible working environment for everybody. And then because we are in healthcare, what kind of healthcare does a terrible working environment provide? Are we living up to our potential as healthcare providers to all of our patients if we have this kind of working environment? These problems are pretty universal. And I would say even top performers are not doing very well in terms of having the right structures in place, making sure their processes are working, and actually tracking outcomes and setting goals for a zero tolerance goal in terms of both harassment and inequity.
Well, ladies, this has been an amazing conversation, but we are running out of time on this episode. So what we learned today is that there's a wide range of deficits and barriers that we still need to overcome. And despite the progress of women before us, and though it's 2019, we still have a long way to go. Would you agree?
Yes, we
would. Oh, yeah.
We're going to pick up next time with the continuation of our conversation with Dr. Cass and Dr. Chu. We'll be talking about mentoring and who benefits from gender equity in medicine.
Spoiler alert, it's everyone.
If you'd like more information, please see our references and show notes at feminem.org. Thanks for joining us today on Closing the Gap, an educational podcast on gender bias in medicine.
And special thanks to our editor and producer, Stacey Gitlin, our research and writing team, Dr. Shamruti Desai, Dr. Elizabeth Dubay, Dr. Danielle Zeal, Dr. Erin Hanlon, Dr. Rachel Ely, Dr. Rachel Bridwell, Dr. Zachary Baker, and Dr. Claire Minvenditti. Shout out to our graphic designer, Dr. David Burkholder. And thank you to our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a Democratic nonprofit EM group in Detroit, and FEM&M. I'm Amber Sobrario.
And I'm Laura Smiley. Please join us next time on Closing the Gap.